Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, welcome to the 412th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Sean Paul Cardaman, and you can check out his work at AmericanPrimitive.org. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan. You can check out my work at DirectedByOren.com. Booyah.
And mine at MrMattEnlow.com.
We were like, we have a podcast for 9 years. We haven't even promoted our own stuff. So why don't we? We're doing it. Speaking of people not promoting the right thing, we just had the Nelms brothers on for 2 hours of the podcast to talk about their movie Red Right Hand, starring Orlando Bloom, coming out in theaters tomorrow if you downloaded this episode on February 22nd. But we barely talked about that movie until the very end. But it sounds really, really cool.
That's because we had such an incredible time talking to them. It's a really rich story. And I think, Oren, you do a good job of setting it up at the beginning. Theirs is a case study in incremental success, right? They start off literally making a movie in essentially their parents' backyard for $1,500 and end up with a movie starring real bona fide movie stars in theaters 15 years later. Not bad, guys. Not bad.
They also made the movie Fat Man, which is stars Mel Gibson as Santa Claus. It's funny, they came to LA basically at the same exact time that I came to LA, maybe 1 year earlier. And they spent the first 10 years just grinding it out. And it's fun. It's like so nerdy, but like when we have filmmakers on that their journey is similar to ours time-wise, it's funny because we all like talk about the same cameras.
Sure.
And we don't get overly technical in this interview, but we do mention a few cameras that democratized filmmaking.
There's a nostalgia to it for sure. Like to be in Los Angeles at the same time as these filmmaking revolutions are happening and being reminded of how fun and electric it felt, you know, like when the internet was a new thing, when good looking cameras were like finally available to people outside of like rental houses, when you didn't have to pay to like shoot film and then transfer it in order to edit it. Like all of this stuff kind of happened as we were in our 20s. And so of course it's like seductive to wax poetic a little bit about the good old days. And I think we did actually a pretty good job of not going too deep. There's a little bit of arc light talk.
Arclight but, love. Yeah. Maybe you'll edit it out.
Probably not.
I mean, people don't even know what the arc light is anymore.
With it's coming back allegedly. So Red Right Hand is available now if you're listening to this, unless you're a super fan, in which case tomorrow. So February 23rd, 2024, you can see it in theaters and also all of the places that you normally rent or buy movies.
Yeah, see Orlando Bloom as you've never seen him before.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into our conversation with the Nelms brothers, I want to take just a minute or two more to talk about our Patreon. Patreon.com/JustShootItPod is the place where you can throw us a buck or two. We've got a new live show coming March 20th. So if you want to be the first to hear about the details of how you can get tickets to come see us live with some incredible filmmakers, patreon.com/justshootitpod. You can sort of support us, throw us a couple bucks. You'll be in the know.
And we'll also plug whatever you want us to plug. Give us your website. Give us your Instagram account. When you sign up, let us know what we should say in the beginning of the episode. And if you are already a patron, email us and remind us to plug you. We'll do it happily.
All right. Well, without any further delay, let's learn about the epic trajectory.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Of the Nelms Brothers.
Okay, we're here with the Nelms Brothers, Ian and Esham.
Either or works, you know, so I would answer to both. I, you know, if you have a tricky name like Esham, you respond to almost anything.
Yeah, that's awesome. And which one of you is older?
Esham is.
Just by a smidge. But I think once you hit our gentlemanly age, that difference just vanishes.
So you guys are filmmakers. I feel like why we were excited to have you all on the podcast. I mean, we've known about you and, you know, I think your last movie, Fat Man, got a ton of press. But just like looking at your career and looking at how you guys keep directing feature after feature. And it like you have kind of this very picturesque, I don't know if it looks like this from your point of view, but like stepping stone type of career where it's like you made a few shorts and then you made an anthology with some friends and then you made a feature with some smaller stars and then another feature with some bigger stars, then another feature with Mel Gibson, and then like now another feature with Orlando Bloom and
Andy McDowell.
And it's like, it just seems like you guys have cracked this code of how to keep making movies and get bigger and bigger every time and get bigger stars. And
yeah, I don't know if we personally, like when you're in the middle of it, it doesn't necessarily feel like that.
Yeah, I'll say we're, you know, ambitious, and as most people are that jump into this business in any kind, right? So you're constantly looking at where you're at and where you need to be or where you want to be or what the next step is.
Sure,
or, you know
sure.
what I mean? So you're always in the forest, hard to see the trees. You're trying to weed whack your way to the other side constantly. And the side just keeps continuing to get further away and thicker because your goals get thicker and further away.
Yeah, and I guess in that way, like we're masochists, right? Like we just keep moving the goal line further and further away. So you like you achieve one hurdle that you're like, oh wow, I don't even know if we, when you first start, you expect to get there, and you're like, oh wow, we made it to this hurdle. We actually like made a feature length film, and then you're like, okay, well, let's up the ante where we're not spending our own money to make one. What does that feel like? You know, so it's just like, and then you get actors and things like that. It just starts building up.
And just from listening to the podcast and listening to you guys talk about your careers, I feel like it's similar. You know, like you guys are. You're making some big commercials, you're working on TV shows, you've got all these features you're working on pushing, and you've got avenues to get them going now. And it's just, you know, it feels like you have a place to do your art in a lot of different avenues. Whereas when you started, you were just kind of like, how the hell do I get somebody to look at this fucking thing? You know, like, how do I get into this place? How do I get into that place? And then when you can get into those places, you're like, okay, how do I get all my stuff made? And then you're like, okay, once you start getting things made, you're like, okay, how do I get bigger things made? And then you start getting bigger things made, and you're like, okay, how do I get that $150 million sci-fi shot that I, why the fuck haven't I gotten that $150 million movie? You know, like we gotta step up our game. You know, you're constantly like pushing each other, which is great.
Yeah. But when you're a directing team, you can each get like a $75 million movie and then together.
Technically
there. But I mean, I'd venture to guess that like, this is not scientific, but like 99 out of 100 filmmakers that go and make their first film, and they, it's an indie film, or they get someone to finance it. It's kind of small, and they're like, okay, we did it. And they premiere at like an okay festival, you know, like a Newport Beach or something like that. And they're like, awesome. Now the next movie is going to get the bigger star. And 99 out of 100 of these filmmakers do not get that next movie.
Don't make that incremental step, and you've continued to do it over and over again.
And they're pushing, and then they have some kids, and they have, then they need to make some money, and then they need to do this, and then they get distracted by this thing and that thing. But it's really hard to just go from one to two, and then I got to two barely, and then from two to three, I just gave up and just started making commercials. Yeah.
No, you're on a hiatus. You'll circle back. You'll get this.
You certainly will. And from what I've heard, you know what I mean? You're making bigger commercials with bigger people and bigger budgets. And like, I can't wait for that moment when those start to coalesce as well, right? When you're like, hey, I'm on the set with Tom Cruise's new commercial, and Tom said he'd come in and do a, you know what I mean? Like, Tom and I are now talking about this new action film that we're going
to, and I'll say this, Ian and I have gone several times to our team and we're like, hey, can we shoot some commercials? And like, you guys have no experience.
So
like, really? They're like, yeah. No, it's a whole different world.
Okay.
Like,
all right.
I guess we're going to be over
guess
here.
Guess we'll go back to features.
When you say when you say team, you mean like your agents and managers? Or
agents and managers, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, that's your first mistake. Those people aren't going to get you commercials.
They're like, yeah. Well, do I get the commission on that?
No. Yeah, we don't know how commercials work. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I just worked on a project, some commercials a couple of weeks ago, and the agency had just done a campaign with Tyler Sheridan, and it was like he was directing, and it made me think about, you know, that thing where like these kind of like well-known filmmakers get to make commercials, and how you have to have such a big brand. Like, I think the commercial he did was like a Western type of thing, like
essentially that you have to be such a big brand that the creatives say things like, oh, we wish this is going to be like if Tyler Sheridan directed a commercial. That's the pitch, right?
Right.
And then someone was like, well, what if Tyler's available? You know what I mean? Like, it.
Yeah. Should we reach out to his people?
Should we reach
a strike
out?
There's a strike. Let's see if they're available.
I do.
We got an extra $10 million.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's try it.
I wonder, with those fancy pants, the name brand directors who are known in the feature world or something like that, if they are doing the same job that Oren and I do, do you know what I mean? Like, I can't imagine that they're laboring through a 4-hour conversation about what pillow we should use, put on the bed. Do you know what I mean? Like we're in the thick of it. Like, teammates with the creative director and really kind of ingratiating ourselves to the team. And I can't imagine that, like, you know, a superstar does that same sort of work. I don't know. I'm curious.
So I will
they
say
absolutely don't.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it depends on who it is. Right. But like, I know, so I did professional storyboards for a few years.
Oh, you were a storyboard artist?
Yes. And so I storyboarded.
Wow. Do you guys know the Pierce brothers?
I was going to say, yeah.
I don't know them.
I don't know.
Yes, have similar vibes.
We are going to put you on a quadruple date, and you'll be best friends.
They're a directing duo. They had the number one movie in America.
They're brother during directing COVID. Duos, one of whom is a professional storyboard artist.
Oh, wow. What was the movie, Oren?
It was called The Wretched.
Oh, gotcha.
I'm going to check it out.
I got to check it
out. Yeah, great.
Always looking for good brother duos.
Absolutely.
But I will say, like, you know, I've had the pleasure of working with some great directors. And they, you know, there, some of them are notable feature directors, and they put up with the same stuff. You know, you have a client, and you're catering to the client. Doesn't matter if you did Spider-Man or whatever. It's you're in that position.
And I think I think that maybe that is their relationship with the client. But in terms of preparing for a job or winning a job, like, I know, I won't name any names, but I know a number of like very famous directors that don't write their own treatments. Mm-hmm. They don't even like know what they're pitching when they get on a call with a client.
That's amazing.
That they have, and they have teams. They have literally, in the same way that composers, you know.
Yeah.
I was shocked on when I made my movie and I, you know, hired a composer. He would introduce me to other people that are writing other parts of music, and then he told me, "Oh, this person is actually in Hans Zimmer's team, and they compose music for him, and he composes music for John Williams." And I was like, are you, I thought John Williams composes the music in Hans Zimmer. And they're like, yeah, they'll do like the main theme, but all this other music is written by all these other people. And, like, and that's, well, listen, I think directors have that too.
If we wanted to hire someone to do a Guy Ritchie impression, you could hire someone else and not hire Guy Ritchie, who's going to hire someone to do an impression of him for the prep. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, well, we were getting ready for another project to go out, and we were just told, hey, just go to the site and use the AI to build your deck. I'm like, are you serious right now? Like, you're actually advocating that we go do that? Like, that's a terrible idea. Like, how am I going to do?
Have you guys tried writing in the style of Nelms Brothers? Into Midjourney? No.
We've never messed with the AI yet.
What's wrong with you guys?
I don't know.
No, we have not endeavored.
You want to tell me that's really Orlando Bloom in your movie?
Actually, Esh just put on a mask and he went for it. Mm-hmm. He killed it.
Okay. I mean, pretty incredible. Well,
okay, so let's talk about your movies for a second. So you mentioned, Esh, that your first movie you guys paid for, right?
Quite a few of them.
Yeah, first few.
We can go through it real quick.
Yeah, how big is the bandwidth for this journey?
Sure, sure.
So
it's good. We'll hit the gas and pump the brakes depending
exactly
on how fast you're going.
How interesting it is. So in 2004, we came into LA in 2002, not knowing anything, not knowing I have a clue, completely naive. Esh started working at Arclight Cinemas. I started working at Tony Roma's, A Place for Ribs, mm-hmm. and then in Beverly Hills, and. We for a year we were writing and you know thinking
Wait,
we were killing
sorry.
It.
I have to ask, what was your favorite movie on your Arclight name tag?
I had Big Lebowski.
Nice, Lebowski.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's
smooth.
They just have like 30 name tags that say Big Lebowski on it.
Oh no, he's like, yeah. I mean, when I once I thought because at the time I was like, oh yeah, no one's got this, and then I went out and there's like three other Big Lebowski.
Like,
oh,
man,
I was like, oh man, I should have. Really
either you're best friends with them now or mortal enemies. It's...
No, they were good. We're all good. It was a tight knit group. I mean,
they were killed.
Yeah. Arclight was great because honestly, it just hired a ton of people that were really passionate about cinema, for better or worse. Better for us, worse for them, because all we would do is just sit around and talk about movies all day.
Yeah, that first wave, especially, you know, that Esham was in, because he got hired like within 3 months of it opening, and everybody in there was, you know,
a cinephile,
was hustling hard and writing at night, and like we would all get together on the weekends and just, I mean, I don't drink, but everyone would sit around, we would all just sit around and drink and hang out and pontificate and, you know, listen to music and then start shooting shorts in our living room, and like we were just going crazy. And then Esham and I were, after about a year of writing and thinking, well, no wonder.
Wait,
you know.
Sorry, real quick. So at Tony Roma's, is everyone just talking about ribs?
Tony Roma's was littered with actors. I can't think of a bunch of them we still work with today. Well, a few of them we still work with today. But
or Orlando Blooming Onion. Is that true that that's where his name came from?
Yeah, there you go. I do want to point out, though.
Like, that's the Outback?
That is Outback. So let's follow. Yeah, yeah. Come on.
Yeah, get your chain restaurant
from the podcast. You know,
I want you to get that Tony Roma's commercial.
Are you still at Tony's Roma's?
Only on the weekends.
Now you get to eat the ribs. The thing that isn't, not to wax philosophical about the good old days of Arclight Cinemas, but like, you know, people write into the show all the time and they'll be like, hey, should I go to film school? It's still a common question, right? And the answer is always, oh, well, you know, that's one way for you to find an education, maybe you needed the structure, blah, blah, blah. But always the big takeaway is like, will you find that group of like-minded people, your squad, your tribe, that you'll be making films with for the rest of your career, right? And I think it's worth highlighting that, like, that experience can happen a lot of different ways. You can get paid working at a movie theater and find that group of people just as much as you can spending tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars at film school instead. You know, it's just kind of like, can you find those hotbeds? And maybe there's a little bit of luck to it as well, right? Like, the new cool theater that's opening up tends to be a magnet for people who care about movies.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And Ian and I, we definitely thought about going to film school. When we moved here, you know, Ian had just graduated with his Bachelor of Arts degree, and I had just dropped out of art school, which I went to Kansas City Art Institute for painting and drawing. I only lasted a year there before I got booted out. Not for anything I did, just lack of interest, and I lost my scholarship because you know, I was a very opinionated artist.
And, butting heads with a couple of teachers.
And I could play the game now, but I you know, my professor and I did not get along, and he made it apparent and rewarded me with the grades appropriately for that. So I came back that summer, and Ian and I were like, man, we'd always had a passion for movies, but we're like, well, let's take this plunge. And we hopped in my Volkswagen van. We loaded up his, what did you have at that time? I don't know, a Toyota Prius or a Camry? A Camry.
I think I had a Camry.
Yeah, Camry. And we came down here and we moved right off of Yucca. Yeah, moved right off of Yucca, you know? And then sure.
We just hopped off the freeway. Basically.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We just hopped off the freeway and we're like, okay, I guess we're here. Like, let's find an apartment.
And any advice anyone asks us is like, you know, what do you think? We're like, do not live in Hollywood. Like, number one. Like,
it's not the place
that
to
is not. I mean, it was cool for about 2 weeks. And then it was like, wow, this is a lot. But so we got jobs within walking distance, and we did the film school tour. So we went to USC, and they were like, hey, if your favorite movie's Star Wars, like, you belong here, you know? Right. And then we went over to like UCLA, and they were like, if your favorite movie's Star Wars, like, get the fuck out.
That was literally what the two intro speeches were.
Yeah.
And then we went to
LA Film School,
and they were like, hey, we got all the equipment. You know, we don't really hold your hand here. We want you to get out there and start busting your ass and making shit. And we're like,
if your favorite movie is Phantom Menace, you're in the right.
But then they were like, yeah, at year three, you'll get to touch all these cameras. And we're like, this is not going to work out.
Yeah.
So I'm driving around in my little beloved 84 Volkswagen van again, which I have to this day, and I get rear-ended in LA. And fortunately, I'm mechanically inclined, so we take the insurance money, and Ian, we find a partner that is equally as enthusiastic about movies at Tony Roma's, and we partner on the DVX-100 camera, which was a game changer at the time. So we just started running around.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Shooting everything, all kinds of short films. Like, I remember we wore the heads out in like 2 weeks. And then we went to the shop to the Panavision.
He's like, I've never seen anything like this in my life.
Yeah, I've never seen a camera with this many hours on the head.
How the hell?
Came out 2 months ago.
It was impossible that we'd already worn out the heads. We're like, no, dude, we've been shooting like constantly.
We never stopped shooting.
but that was it. We just started making movies, and they weren't great, right? We were writing like, you know, films we could go shoot in the woods with with like five friends from the restaurant.
And that was the first feature we shot, is we wrote something. And I remember I put the script together. We were like, we got to make something we could shoot. This is after being a year in LA. Because people would read our stuff and they're like, this is fucking huge. How are you going to get a $50 million budget for this? And we're like, I don't know. Don't they hand those out somewhere?
I mean, I think the first thing we wrote was like, Mad Max meets Saving Private Ryan.
That was
like
the pitch line.
You're like, Tom Cruise walks into an airport.
And then, we quickly realized after a year that, like, we're not going to get these made. We got to start at the bottom here and start making something we can make. And obviously the problem is that they haven't seen anything made of our wonderful dialogue and scripting. So once we get something on like an actual movie here, you know, we're obviously going to win Sundance and be toast to the town. So we put $1,500 together.
wait, but why did you think that you guys, like, did you have like your own style, or were you kind of like doing like,
we knew nothing.
We have no idea what we're doing. Like, no, not even close. Like, we weren't watching Tarantino and being like, we got to cut like this. We were just like,
we knew what we liked. Like, we liked Tarantino.
Easy, we liked Tarantino a lot, but we were like watching Five Easy Pieces and Last Picture Show and kind of had that in our heads as we were kind of motoring into it.
Not that what we made was
anywhere near as good as those. Yeah. Not even
those were not the films I was expecting you guys to name drop. Right? Sure.
No, not at all.
Tootsie. Yeah. Graduate.
So we go out and we make, Ian writes this script.
So we're trying to figure out what to write. I just, in like 2 or 3 months, write this script, and it was like 82 pages long, and I pass it to Eshnoff. Like, I've done it. I've got the golden goose here.
And you wrote it in Movie Magic.
Back when Movie Magic was a thing. He reads it and he goes, And I'm like, what'd you think, man? We're ready to go, right? He's like, I think we could make this into something. That's what his comment was.
But it was just like going out there, and we knew we could go shoot it for nothing. Our dad lit it with stuff we'd bought at Walmart, like a
bounce
card.
Our mom and dad were professional photographers for about 20 years. And he still had some equipment in the garage because he'd sold the business by the time we had finished college. And
Did they live in LA?
No, they live in they live in Woodlake, California, which is basically Visalia adjacent, a half an hour behind Visalia near the Sequoia Forest. So he had a couple of studios. He had one in Porterville, one in Visalia, one in Hanford, and he had a lab in Visalia as well. So he was like king of the valley there. But he never really went to LA, or he never really just leveled up. He was just kind of like, hey, I'm good here. But he still had some equipment in the garage, and we're like, all right, well, let's get some of Dad's equipment. Dad, can you help us light this? And it was a 3-man crew. It was me and Esh switching off on the camera and mic, and our dad came out to help light.
Yeah.
And so and Dad was like, light,
lit with strobe light.
Well, Dad, well, so we, our location was, we're like, hey, let's go shoot this in the woods. That was fucking bright. So mm-hmm. nowhere to plug anything in. We had to buy like 10 batteries and we had to charge them every night. We shot for 7 days, which felt like 7 days straight.
And just to clarify for any young listeners out there, when you say batteries, you mean camera batteries. You couldn't run lights off of any sort
exactly.
of battery.
Exactly. There's like, nothing
this
out
is
there.
This is a pre-LED era, basically.
Yeah. 100%. And so the whole thing was lit with a Coleman lantern from Walmart at night. Like we were shooting night scenes around a campfire.
Shooting fucking night scenes.
And we got
that's
the fire.
They're pointing all the car headlights, right? Yeah.
The cars were
there
too
were
far
no
away.
Cars. There were no
down by a river.
We had to hike a mile and a half in. So Dad got the horses and put all the equipment on the back of the horses.
Wait, you guys own horses?
Our parents
own
do.
Horses. Yeah, we do. So they packed in the equipment for a mile and a half because it was too heavy for everybody to carry a mile and a half. And then, Dad hopped off the horse, tied him up, and then for the next 8 or 9 hours, we were down there shooting our asses off.
And we got a movie out of it. And we ended up going to Palm Beach Film Festival. We learned how to edit. We didn't have any idea how to edit, so I cracked open the Final Cut Pro manual, and I read that thing.
He read the entire 1,000-page or 800-page manual. And then
I showed Ian how to do it.
Showed me how to do it, because I was like,
20
I'm,
minutes.
I'm not fucking reading that thing. And then we put the movie together. We got into Palm Beach International Film Festival, which was like a top 10 film festival or top 20, sorry, top 20 film festival at the time in the early 2000s. And we went there and we were just kind of, it was kind of amazing. We were sitting in 250 seat actual movie theaters, like AMC movie theaters, watching mm-hmm. it with like 50 people and then 20 people. And people were laughing at the right places. And we became so self-conscious after that screening. We cut it from 82 minutes to 72 minutes when we got home because we were just sure. like, it's got to go quicker. What were we thinking? This is like once yeah, we saw it with an audience, we're just like, oh, fuck, we see all the flaws.
So essentially, it was an extended short.
But we were completely hooked. We were just like, oh, we got to do this again.
Yeah.
So we got into a handful of other film festivals, but with that one, but we immediately went to our filmmaker friends who were working at ArcLight with Esh, and we said,
and many of them had graduated from film school.
Yeah, a bunch of them were film school grads,
and
were,
Peter Atencio is among that group,
who is a high school film,
which
school
a film too. High school,
film high school. We were like, what? Where's that at? Colorado, what? Apparently, the Mecca.
I'd forgotten that Peter was on the show, boy, years ago now, yeah. And has a
was it for Keanu or something?
I think it me. Was it Keanu? I think it was. What did he do after King that? Peele. Before
no,
did,
it was like a TV well, show. He was
oh, like, Van Damme Johnson or something.
It was that heart that
yeah, yeah.
Was it that like giant a, TV show that
it was, yeah, it was like an action
yeah,
it was
yeah,
like
yeah.
Shot in like in the Czech Republic or something. I don't know.
Right, I can't remember the
yeah,
name.
Yeah,
but
in Prague. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah,
wait. So did you guys sell this movie? What was the name of this first movie?
My first movie was called Squirrel Trap, aptly named. It was a comedic thriller, as we called it.
About five junior college kids that go into the woods to write a paper on Thoreau,
and things go a little crazy.
Someone goes off their meds.
One of them goes off his meds.
You can imagine the rest.
But so
not a cinematic triumph by any means.
I think
it did get into festivals.
Got into film festivals.
It got
like,
into film festivals.
Like, were you guys like, okay, let's quit our jobs? This we found our calling.
Absolutely not.
And we were like, we got to work a lot harder because we're getting a lot bigger budget.
And we were just like, wow, we have so much to learn.
Yeah, we saw all the flaws in it, obviously, and we're just like, shit. Okay, but we were hooked. Like, we loved it. The experience was awesome.
And really, honestly, we were like, oh, wow, I'm going to really enjoy getting better at this.
And a lot of people at that film festival, like, it was such a new camera and such a new age, the digital age, that had literally just come out months before. And we pop up at a film festival with possibly one of the first feature film shot on that thing. Cause it was like 3 months after that camera came out, we had a feature film at Palm Beach International Film Festival shot on that thing. And everyone was like, what? What? What'd you
do? Well, I remember we were like riding Panasonic and we're like, hey, the sound is drifting out of sync because no one had cut anything over 15 minutes with the camera.
Sure. And so after 20 minutes, it starts drifting 2 frames.
Yeah. And so then they came out with that a patch. Frame sync like a few months later, but we had to like go and like start just cutting the timeline, and like sliding it over every 15
But it was
minutes.
The first time they'd even heard it when we were using the camera. They were like, what? What? And we're like, it's fucking slipping.
Sorry, this is probably not interesting to anyone, you know, under 30. But like, was it like the 239698 drift issue? Was that what it was? Like, what you were, it was it pull down?
Yeah, the pull-down issue. Yeah,
it's a standard def, right? So you're cutting like 60i or something, right?
Well,
like,
yeah, it was
24p over 60i.
The 24p with the pull-down interlaced or whatever it was, the 3.24 frame thing.
And it was like mini DV tape.
Yep, mini DD, exactly. Yeah,
standard def. And,
yep, and we were like, this is liberating everybody. We're all going to be out like Francis Coppola had proclaimed, making our masterpieces.
Right. The coolest thing was that we were at that festival, like the other lowest budgeted film at that entire festival was another one for $150,000. And they were just like, what the fuck did you spend on your film? And we're like, $1,500. And they're just like, what? We're like, what was your budget? And they're like, 150,000. We're like, what? They're like, we thought we were fucking scraping the bottom at 150 grand. We're like,
well, they probably were.
And they shot it on film, so like everybody else was on film.
Well, they shot it in high def. On those.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, shot on big high def camera.
They did have high def.
But yeah. So then after that, we came back. We showed our friends, and they were polite. You know, I wouldn't say that they were blown away.
No one was tripping over themselves, thinking how genius it was. But we had made a film, and I think that was literally the comment one of our best friends said after we screened it at the house. He was like, well, we're out on the balcony, everyone's smoking cigars, and he's like, well, you made a film. That was the comment.
And honestly, like, that was enough for us. You know, we made a film, and like, and then they came to us
and
like,
you were acknowledged as filmmakers.
We are now just for the record, guys, don't say that to anybody ever. Like, figure something else out.
Ah, you made a film. Really?
Way to go.
Yeah.
We all know what that means.
I think it depends on the tone.
No. There's an old 30 Rock joke where Tina Fey's character would go to see Jenna's shows, and she would say things like, oh, I really loved the lights, and it was like a montage of every time she would say something.
Yeah, not quite like a kick in the nuts, but maybe like an elbow in the nuts.
Yeah.
It's not a compliment, not hate. It's just like, well, okay, hey, you know, something.
But people were like, hey, how do we get on board this train?
Yeah, the one thing they was really excited that we were actually able to make something. They were just like, holy shit, like, you know, these poor bastards working these shitty jobs and not having any money were able to actually put together a feature film that screened at a festival. That's crazy. And so we got 3 months later, we were in production shooting Night of the Dog, which was the second one. And what we did was we just went and got our filmmaker friends. There were 6 of us. I think 4 of us ended up writing and directing our own short. I think it was 5, but the 5th one got cut out just because we started screening it. And the 5th one was, it needed work. And the filmmaker was kind of like,
we were already at a feature length time.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to put that much work into it. And we're like, all right, well, maybe we go down to 4. And then he just became a producer on it and was like, yeah, that's fine.
And he was like in the other ones.
And he was acting in all the other ones, which was his passion anyway. So he was totally fine. But
yeah, and then so that one ended up, we've spent a whole $5,000 on that one.
That one was $5,000.
And then we went to all the film festivals that we barely squeaked into with that one. And we ended up winning awards at them.
Yeah, we won a bunch of screenwriting awards. We won a big award at Santa Barbara International Film Festival, which came with like a distribution award. And we refused to take the distribution because, of course, Focus and Miramax were going to call at that point.
Sure.
Of
course. Which they ironically did.
They actually did. Focus called. Miramax called. Neither of them wanted to distribute it. But
we got the call.
We got the call and they wanted to watch it. And they were just like, what? Because we kept winning all these festivals. And they were just like, what the fuck is it about this film? And it was highly entertaining. Like everybody really, you know, really tried to lay it all out on the table screenwriting wise. But I think the production level was just so low, you know, at $5,000, and we're literally shooting in the streets of Los Angeles with like 600 feet of extension cord, crossing streets at 4 o'clock in the morning. Cops are rolling by.
Is this still DVX-100?
Yes. Oh yeah. And so we put that film together. We won like, I don't know, half a dozen film festivals.
And we actually had 2 DVXs because I know Peter Atencio bought one.
That's right. Sure. Peter bought one.
And then we had one. And so we were all out running around.
It was cool because we actually were cross shooting and like we were like, this makes cutting so much easier. But it was shit. It looked fucking garbage. Yeah. But you could cut it together, cross cut it. We're like, wow, if we had a another light, this would look fucking great. Well, it looked terrible, but great to us.
but it was fun and it ended up charming a lot of audiences. And we ended up getting some audiences awards. And on we went to the next one. So
it influence you, like, I guess from the directing part of it, like the working with actors or blocking scenes or choosing camera angles? Were you guys, do you feel like those first few features kind of helped establish your tone and like the way the types of filmmakers you are?
I think that what we were able to see was that the writing was working. We felt like the writing was working after Night of the Dog. We felt like we had finally hit a little bit of a stride of like, okay, well, I can see some of this working now. Whereas
finding a voice.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Some of this is actually working.
Yeah. Like I think it worked on an entire feature level. Not that we wrote the whole thing, but like we were able to intertwine all of our voices enough to make it work. And I know in Squirrel Trap, there were parts that worked.
Yeah, parts. That's a good way to put it. In Squirrel Trap, parts worked. And in Night of the Dog, the whole thing kind of worked. Like everybody was laughing at all the segments as we were intercutting them. And we were able to put the gold back to back to back. So it was pretty stacked up with entertainment and laughs and keeping people mystified.
Were the stories related to each other in Night of the Dog?
So that was
one of the fun ways that we put it together. Go ahead.
So the concept was, and we'd all gone through like critical breakups at the time. So we were all like,
you're in your early 20s. You've had a couple of bad
breakups.
We all
moved to LA to fulfill our dreams. We all had girlfriends at the time, and then we all became single.
Everyone's like, living off $7.50 an hour of work.
Tell me why. I don't know why it is, but that's like contagious. One of us got single, and they just rippled throughout the whole group. So we're all sitting there crying in our Cheerios, drinking cheap beer, and we're like, "Wow, we should really make a movie about this." And so the premise was, "Hey, we're gonna do all of us five idiots. It's got to start in the same place. So it started at a movie theater." Truly original, right?
Everybody
we all worked
at
the movie
theater
anyway, so we're like, "Hey, why don't we just go shoot at the movie theater?" And it was five guys. They did not, but we got another one.
Arclight let us use a room upstairs for Squirrel Trap one time, and that was super big of them. That was awesome for nothing. And then in Night of the Dog, we went to Bakersfield, where I went to college, and rented out an actual like massive theater. Not rented it out, but a buddy of mine was a manager there, and he was like, "Yeah, come in after 1 o'clock in the morning, I'll let you shoot for 4 hours and I'll just hang out."
We're like, "Hey, can we trade you like cleaning the popcorn machines or
something?"
Right.
And we put him in it. We put him in it because he was an actor as well, but you know, living in Bakersfield, and he was excited for us to just come down and do something there. So we used that theater. We shot about 4 or 5 hours one night from like 1 to 6 o'clock in the morning or something like that.
That's like a pretty good tip then. I don't think we've ever talked about over like 400 episodes, which is like, make friends with managers of locations.
Sure. Especially outside of Los Angeles. Like, who doesn't want to be in a movie if you live in Bakersfield?
Right.
Like here, if we wanted to shoot a commercial in a movie theater, they'd charge us like $10,000.
Yeah.
Easy.
And you'd still shoot from 1 to 4 a.m.
You know? Exactly. 100%. And I can't tell you how many times we've called in the network of who we know, right? Hey, we go, like, this person owns this warehouse. Let's go see if we can throw them in it and do that.
It's a version of the hometown feature, like I saw. I'm curious, though, while you guys are shooting this movie, I imagine this is one of the earliest times that you're on set around other directors. It's a relatively rare thing, right? So, like, if you're all kind of wearing different hats, and I imagine, like, one of you's holding the boom pole for the other person when it's their time to direct, and, you know, just kind of, like, trading and helping each other out, did that inform your craft and process, seeing how other people were doing it for their pieces? Or was 100%. It more just kind of, like...
For sure.
Like, I mean, some of them went to film high school.
Yeah. I mean, look, everyone was fucking up in magical ways on every one of those shorts. And everybody was just like, not going to do that. Ooh, that was a good idea. And then we get to the next one and be like, "God, that was a fucking disaster. But wow, that was brilliant." You know, it was like there were moments that were just fucking brilliant. And then there were moments that were just like, "Wow, what a fucking disaster."
Like,
you know?
let's not leave the catering meat platter in your trunk overnight.
And then try to feed it to the crew, or do feed it to the crew.
Yeah.
And get everybody sick. Everyone's vomiting.
That's a bad idea.
Did you guys feel like the filmmaking was competitive at all? That everyone's like, "Oh, yeah. Like,
yeah, sure.
Esh came up with a really good shot. And
you
mine
see that shot,
kind of
Esh did? Yeah, yeah.
I think we were healthily, thank goodness. We were all really good friends. And we were all healthy, competitive. And because I feel like we would all help each other, you know what I mean? Like, so everyone would crew each other's film. That was the whole idea. So there was nothing but like trying to help each other out, especially since none of us knew anything.
Yeah. And we'd also entered a make a movie in 24 hour contest.
That was the first time we'd all worked together. Right in between those two movies, there was a point where they had this contest in New York, and they were like, "Hey, make a movie in 24 hours, start in your hometown, do one in 48 hours and then send it in, and we'll pick the best one in each area. And then you come to New York and we'll fly you over.
We'll fly you in if you win and you can do one there." So we got all those same collaborators and we made a movie in 48 hours.
Yeah, like
we ended up qualifying. So they flew us to New York.
And that was a great experience.
And we all ran around New York and made a movie.
Yeah, that was a really fun experience too. Yeah, it was super fun. But we all got used to each other working that way. And then when we were doing these features, I mean, there were just, I mean, and the cool thing was, is it didn't cost a lot of money. We didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have any money. So it didn't cost any money to like jump back out on the street at 3 o'clock in the morning and shoot a reshoot. So there was a lot of that. Oh, that came out like shit. I can't cut that. Jeremy needs to get to the damn tree quicker. You know, it was like, he's running around in the background with in his underwear. And I like, he's got to be in this shot. So it was like a bunch of crazy shit like that. So cops came thinking we had a crackhead on the streets running around in his underwear. And they're like, what is this fucking guy doing just in his underwear running around the streets? And we're like, at 3 o'clock in the morning, we're like, oh, sorry, we're shooting a movie. They're like, okay, we didn't hear that. We're going to drive around the block. We're going to come back in 25 minutes and you fuckers better be gone. And we're like, okay. And we would shoot for 25 minutes. And then we were like, all right, they said 25 minutes. We got to go now or they're going to stop us, you know, when we go two blocks over. So it was like, we would shoot and then we'd pack up and run out of there. And they were just kind enough to let us finish.
And so anyways, that one turned out to be amazingly successful. We worked with like five of our best friends and we got representation. And then the first thing the representation says is, okay, stop screwing
around
with these little
cheap... show anybody this shitty little movie again.
Well, yeah. And they were like, hey.
And what, sorry, reps are like agents, you mean, or managers?
We got a manager. I had this, here's a good thing for, you know, career building, right? So while we were living in our apartment over in Hollywood, we read Rebels on the Backlot.
Sharon Waxman's
book. Amazing fucking book. And what it talked about in there is we were big Tarantino fans. So we were like in Paul Thomas Anderson fans and obviously all the 90s filmmakers. Like, we were fucking lapping it up. So we read this book and it talks about this manager named Catherine James, who was Roger Avery and Quentin Tarantino manager while they were trying to come up and all the way through him doing like Pulp. And I think that's where it ended after Pulp. But so she was his manager and the cool stories in there would be like, she's this daughter of a preacher out of the Midwest. And she would go into these, like agents and producers and big companies with scripts, Tarantino's and Avery's and other people's that she believed in. And they would literally say in the book, like that she would stand on the fucking table. She would burst in while they were in a meeting. Oh, sorry, don't go in there, Catherine. She would burst into a meeting and be like, why haven't you read that fucking script? I sent it to you 2 weeks ago. It's the best fucking thing I've ever had. Da, 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 da. She'd stand on their desk while they're in a meeting and be like, you need to read this script. And they'd be like, what the H? And then she would just get down and walk out. And she's like, and they were like, but she's a tiger. Like she's like a brownie making mother who is a tiger and a half. And we're like, that's who we fucking need. We need that woman. I want someone standing on tables who knows how to do this, who broke Tarantino and Roger Avery, like some of our heroes. So I find her email. Right. And I'm like, okay, I'm fucking emailing this woman.
Sure.
So I email her and I'm like, hey, here's who we are. You know, we're this brother making film duo.
Not as audacious as standing on her desk, but no.
Yeah.
And so I just email her and I ship it off. Nothing. A week later, I'm like, I'm fucking doing it again. I email her again. And every time I'm saying new shit, because we were actually in the middle of Night of the Dog at that point. So I was like, hey, we did this movie Squirrel Trap, you know, got into a few festivals. Then the next one, I'm like, hey, we won this festival with Night of the Dog. We won this festival with Night of the Dog. So I actually had all these fucking updates coming in. And the other thing I was
like, hey,
doing,
Miramax called.
Right. Miramax called. Focus called. And then I think the last one that got her was I threw this email out and we'd already written Fat Man at that point.
Wait, and she's not responding to any.
She's not really responding to zero. She's not responding to anything.
Ian is like water torture. Like it's just so, like very like.
But it was all very positive. It
you
was
would
all
make a good, you positive. You would make a good, very good publicist.
Yeah, for truly. Is it a different thread each time or are you replying to the same thread?
No, different thread, different email. Hey, it's Ian again, you know, that kind of thing. And every time I tell her about something new, either we won a festival or, hey, we just got into this festival or, and I would always sort of finish with like the exciting project that we had, like that we were pumped about, either a script that we had written and we just did a polish on, or a script that we're thinking about writing, or a script that got a great read from our neighbor who's a first AD on a TV show, you know, like stupid shit like that. But that's what we had. That's all we fucking had. So I would just email.
And you weren't sending the same email to 30 other reps?
No, one. I had one in mind. I figured
that's incredible.
In our mind at that time, right, we had a certain aesthetic that we were writing like, and it was kind of like this crime thriller. It was a funky crime thriller, like with comedic undertones, you know, and emulating, but not really emulating. Like there's
like emulating.
No, but I mean, like we love Tarantino. We love
David O. Russell.
David O.
Fincher.
Like, you knew she was the person for you.
I felt like she would get it because we were a little funky. You know what I mean? We weren't like. Yeah. Oh, this is a fucking Hallmark original. Oh, this is a, it, we didn't fit in a box at all. And everybody she was repping didn't fit in a box. And I was like, we don't fit in a box. I think this is our girl. So I emailed her for 6 weeks straight. Every week I would send her a new email. And finally on the sixth week, and it's funny because the email I sent, had Fat Man in it. We'd finished that script, or we were about to finish that script. And I sent it to her, and this is maybe like 2005. That's when I think we finished that Fat Man script in 2005. If you can fucking believe that.
15 years before you shot it.
Yeah. So I sent her like, hey, this is what we've got. This cool script, Fat Man, some Santa, blah, blah, blah. And so she writes me back like 3 days later, and I'm like, holy shit, she wrote us back. Like, it's been fucking 6 weeks of water torture, and she finally wrote us back. But I stayed super positive. I was never pissy in the email or a dick or, you know, like getting uppity that she wasn't getting back to me. I just stayed super naively positive. And she gets back to me, and she's like, that sounds interesting. Send me the Fat Man script. And I'm like, oh shit, okay. She's gonna fucking read something. Holy shit. So I send her the Fat Man
script. That's like so Hollywood too, right? You write paragraphs and they respond in like six words.
Exactly. That's exactly what she did. She sent like this little email. That sounds interesting. Send Fat Man. I'm like, fuck, okay, shit. I send it off. So like it must have been midnight on like, and I think I had told her, hey, we work late. We're up till like 2 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, working on this shit, blah, 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 blah. Just pouring out my heart a little bit in some of these emails. So she calls us at like midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. And she's like,
which is so Catherine,
which is fucking Catherine to the hilt. It's like what you read about and you're like excited to have happen, right? Especially in your early 20s. She called us at like 1 o'clock in the morning or midnight or something. And was like, this is Catherine James. And I was like, holy shit. She's on the fucking phone at 1 o'clock in the morning. She's like, I've read Fat Man. I really enjoyed it. I think we need to get some Italian food and sit down and talk about this. And we're like, holy fuck. So she's
right
like,
now?
Exactly. Exactly. So she's like, what's your Wednesday look like or whatever. And two or three days later, we're sitting down with her at this Italian restaurant. And she couldn't be more amazingly eccentric.
She's like, I hope you don't mind, but I stand on tables while I eat.
Well, she's so fucking amazing.
Has a fear of sitting down.
She was super quirky.
She would go to these restaurants and she would be like, do you have any fresh basil? And we're like, fuck, dude, what the fuck? And she's like, you're an Italian restaurant. She's like, I need fresh basil. They're like, okay, let me see if I can get you that. And we're right next to a grocery store.
Probably.
Yeah.
And they would run over there and literally get it for her. And she'd be like, they're like, can I see your dessert menu? And she'd bring the dessert menu. And then she'd be like, do you have fresh cream? And they're like, what? Fresh cream and strawberries. That's all I really want. Just a dish of fresh cream with strawberries in it. She'd order that everywhere. And everyone's just like flipping out trying to get just strawberries and fresh cream. And she was just wildly eccentric and awesome. And fucking, so we just sit there and talk to her about the script. She gets excited. And at the very end of it, she's just like, okay, I think I'm repping you guys. And we're like, holy fuck. And so she picked us up and we were with her, I think, for 4 years.
Yeah.
And she was fucking awesome. She called us at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning while we were still working and just fucking talk fucking business. It was crazy. She calls normal hours too. And then she'd like invite us over at 2 o'clock in the morning or midnight and just be like, you guys still up? I'm thinking about making brownies, or I'm thinking about making just some butter with some toast and some fresh garlic. And we're like, fuck, all right, we're coming over. You know, we drive over the hill. It took 15 minutes in the middle of the night. She was just amazing. And so we'd just sit there and talk movies with her. We were with her for 4 years.
And she would just give us like scripts to read, and she had like a whole wall of
fuck. That was the fucking amazing thing, right? We're all our heroes. She's got all their old scripts and shit that didn't sell in piles around the house, like stacked like fucking a hoarder.
I remember before my best friend's birthday came out, like she had a copy of it. She was like, hey, do you want to see Quentin's first movie?
And hey, do you want to read the fucking script? So she would like hand us like this 80-page script that was my best friend's birthday. And we're like, what the fuck is this? I've never heard of this.
Yeah, she's like, oh, do you want to meet Craig? He wrote it with him.
Oh, you want to read these two or three Roger Avery scripts I have that have never been produced that like got him in a ton of rooms? We're like, yes. You know, it was like a bunch of crazy shit like that. She's like, oh, let me see. And she'd go into like a 6 foot high pile of stacked screenplays and start going through them and trying to find it. Like,
she's like, guys, spot me. The tower is like,
wait. So did you guys make anything with her?
She got us a bunch of meetings and we met a ton of people that were producers that were at Warner Brothers and like Eric Olson, we're still buddies with.
Yeah.
And we haven't made anything with Eric yet, but like he was running Dark Castle, which was a wing of Joel Silver at Warner Brothers when he had his deal at Warner Brothers.
But it's, so you unfortunately,
guys, you're in your like your building phase, right? Like you've got a couple films under your belt, a little bit of attention, but it's like it's networking time, right? It's not just your buddies at the movie theater anymore. It's like you're on the water bottle tour for a while.
Basically. Yeah, well, like you guys know how to make a movie, but now you're learning how Hollywood works.
They were like, okay, write a fucking script that we can actually fund. Let's get out of the $10,000 and below category and do something real. And that was before Mumblecore. That was before the $10,000, you know, Mumblecore movement or Dogma fucking movies were really kicking off. And so Joe
was charming. Are you guys still Tony Roma's Arclight?
Yes. Yes, we are. You know what? Actually, I started a swim business at that point. And I was teaching 2 and 3 year olds to swim.
And I was probably storyboarding at this moment.
Yeah. So
2 year olds. Come on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Year
back
and a half.
Floats?
We got a year and a half. No, swimming across the pool with breaths at a year and a half. I got video.
Oh, wow.
It's not everybody.
It's not everybody. It's crazy. The phenom kid that can do that. But you get the athletic ones and you're like, oh, shit. Little Billy's going to be, you know.
It's going to be that protege.
Little Phelps. but we would go over, hang out with her. She'd get us these crazy meetings based on these scripts that we would write.
And unfortunately, she ended up passing away.
Yeah.
Catherine was, you know, cancer survivor. It beat it 3 times before. We didn't know this when we got repped by her, and unfortunately, it came back and took her.
Yeah, it took her. I can't remember what year it was, but it was 4 years after we got repped by her, and we stayed with her until she passed away.
And she ended up lining us up with other reps.
Yeah, she got us a rep at ICM while we were with her at the end there, because we had a script that had kind of caught on a little bit, and that was getting us in a ton of rooms. It got us into ICM. Heyday Pictures was going to do it at the time, and then ended up not doing it. But from that attention, we started getting agents and managers. You know, she got us another manager and we had an agent.
That entered like a very kind of frustrating phase, but we're grateful for it now because we didn't end up making anything for several years except short films.
Not several, but what was it? From 2006 to 2011.
Well, we did
that. 5 years. 5 years. Yep. Yeah. So it was 5 years of us just writing our asses off and getting close, a lot of close. Mm-hmm. And then we got really pissed off and frustrated. And we're like, what got us here was making stuff. We got to get back out there. Oh, it was a very Patton-esque moment as we were cheering each other on. And then we
like, let's go do it.
Yeah.
I am curious, though, before we get into, I know it's crazy that I'm saying this, but before we get into like that galvanized moment of like, let's go do it again. Right.
Yeah.
I'm curious about those years when you're in those rooms and it feels close. Like you're getting heat. You wrote a cool script that people are excited about.
Right. You're lunching at the Chateau Marmont.
Like it feels real. It feels like Hollywood
producers,
you know, somebody's valeting your car or whatever, you know, like it feels real. What were the things that made you think these movies were going to happen? What kept you from going to shoot another thing? Do you know what I mean? Like, what are those false flags is what I'm getting at.
We got so close with this script.
Yeah. I mean, like, we had actors
for 2 or 3 years
attached,
dragging,
you know,
on
like actors, famous actors.
On. Yeah. I mean, they're well known. I mean, we just made a movie with one of them.
Yeah. So we would attach these folks. I don't want to get too crazy into it just because it gets, I don't know. But we had name actors on this script. And a few iterations of it. And it was like a $5-6 million movie. We had New Regency was going to fund it. And we were marching. We had an Oscar winner that was a producer on it. And it was like marching down the aisle. We were like, holy shit, it's happening. It's finally, oh my God. Like our lives are changing, you know, in like,
I mean, we
were
like, hey, like we were at that point. So it's such disbelief. Like we went to our agent. We're like, what do we tell people? They're like, tell people you're making this movie.
Yeah.
And it's got this person.
And it's got this person and this person in it. And we're like, fuck, oh my God, this is like, it's happening.
Like, call your parents, let them know.
And then like 3 months later, we like just nothing had happened. And we're like, guys, what's going on? You know what? We need these meetings with the actors so we can like, we're, you know, like nothing, just nothing was coming together.
But I would tell you this, like, every turn someone was trying to pull the rug out from under us,
for sure,
in a respect. With that one, they ultimately were trying to do a bait and switch on us and like get us off of as directors,
because we hadn't directed anything but those two, you know, a $1,500 and a $5,000 film with nobody in them, just us and our friends. So they were like, one of the big excuses was, well, you guys don't know how to, you don't know how to deal with A-list actors, and now you have A-list actors on this, and I don't think you guys can handle it. And we're like, we can handle it. And we would do meetings with the actors, and talk to them, and they're like, hey, we're on board. The actors were like, hey, we're on board. These guys know what the fuck they're talking about. Let's go. Let's go. And then we would get a call 2 or 3 days later from the producers saying, hey, look, I know that meeting went really well, but we're not confident. It's our contacts. It's our money. And what we want to do is get a friend of ours who just got nominated for an Oscar for a short film to direct it. And we're like, I see what's happening. They've been kind of holding out that this guy is going to direct it. And they're kind of telling him he's going to get to. And we are the roadblock because we keep having successful meetings with execs and with actors. We're kind of fucking this up for them. So they thought.
And were the shorts that you made like kind of proving that you can direct?
They weren't representative of the tone or scope.
Nothing. We didn't have anything really that was – Night of the Dog was semi-representative of it, but the budget and the lighting, it just looked like shit. It looked like two idiots out there shooting that didn't even go to film school is what it looked like. You know what I mean? But highly entertaining. Writing's good, you know, or whatever. And like we just did not have their confidence for whatever reason. Many reasons. Let me say many reasons.
And this happens to, I think, every filmmaker when they come to LA. They have a project. They got some interest. People are talking, and every single writer director at some point is asked by a friend of theirs, hey, if they just offered to make your movie for $6 million, would you be okay not directing? Hey, everyone. We are interrupting this episode with the Nelms Brothers. Their stories are so fun and so good.
Talk about a cliffhanger. So good.
We did talk to them for over 2 hours. And we really didn't want to cut too much from the conversation, so we decided to split this episode up into two parts. You will hear the riveting conclusion to the Nelms Brothers episode. Another full hour of how they made Fat Man and how they made Red Right Hand.
Their new movie with Orlando Bloom.
All the fun stuff. Which now that I think about it, their publicist will probably be like, wait, you didn't release the Red Right Hand info? In the episode that's supposed to come out right around Red Right Hand. Well, we talked about it in the intro, so we got it. Check out the movie, but also come back next week for the second half of our conversation with Ian and Eshin Nelms, and you will have your brain blown.
Blown.
Or at least you'll hear some fun stories, and you'll kind of hear how they went from tiny, no-budget movies to giant movie star movies. In a very quick 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
Like the rest of us. Overnight successes. Okay. We'll catch you next time.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.